And one of the best pieces of advice I ever had from a business consultant in my first business was, he just said, look, double your prices, see what happens. You may lose a couple of customers, but you'll probably keep most of them and you'll be making twice the money.
Today, we talk the psychology of price. How much are you worth? What is the unconscious price you've placed on your life, your self-esteem? The same way changing the price of a product or service changes how people value the offering, it's the same way changing the price you have in your mind will change who and what you attract. Perhaps it's time to change your price. Hey guys, welcome to the Brandon Brand Show. I'm Timothy Maurice, your behavioral psychology author. And today, my goal is for you to rethink how you price your products and yourself. How much are you really worth? Are your goods priced too low, crippling demand? Price influences perception. And today, I get a chance to share a conversation with the author of The Psychology of Price, How to Use Price to Increase Demand, Profit, and Customer Satisfaction, Lee Caldwell. Lee is an economist and mathematician and the founding partner of The Irrational Agency, a behavioral science firm helping brands understand their consumer psychology and deepest desires. I want the insights in this episode to help you attract better people, build better relationships with consumers. Meet Lee Caldwell. Enjoy. Lee, welcome. How are you, man?
I'm not bad, thanks. Just recovering from cold, but I should be ready to speak to you today. Lovely to meet you.
Yeah, same, man. You are in Canada at the moment.
Yeah, I'm at the TED conference in Vancouver, and just an attendee this time, not a speaker, but I am very much enjoying getting to hear some new ideas here at one of the kind of best places for that to happen.
Yeah, and the networking is really awesome as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. So we're going to kick off the show with my favorite feature on any podcast. It happens to be on my podcast called Inside the Mind. Can we go inside your mind?
Yeah, I will open up my brain to you.
Awesome. Well, here we go. Inside your mind, you can only choose one: winter or summer?
Let's say winter. It's underrated, and it's a very beautiful time of year.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought I was the only one. Hunting or fishing?
Oh wow. I guess fishing. I've never hunted, so I have occasionally fished. My dad used to take me fishing as a kid, so that's the only one that I've got experience with. So let's say fishing.
Let's say we teleported you back to a teenager, and this is with the benefit of what you know now: math class or art class?
Really interesting. So art class. If I'm getting everything I know now, because I'm a mathematician, so you know I have all that math knowledge already. I hope I have all the math knowledge of that today's teenagers are getting. Maybe they've moved on. But yeah, art class. I kind of missed out on a lot of that as a teenager, so I would probably go back and try and okay, pick up some more.
Awesome. Tea or coffee?
Coffee. So I heard you ask this to somebody else. I'm a coffee lover. Being British, tea is a big thing for us, and my fiance is a Persian, so tea is also huge for their culture. But I've managed to hold out so far, and I'm still a coffee addict.
The tangible or intangible?
Intangible. That's a big theme for me. And I think that the objects in our heads that are the intangible things that are important to us are as valuable and more valuable often than the tangible possessions that we have. So yeah, I'm going for that.
Sunrise or sunset?
It's pretty rare for me to see the sunrise, so let's go for the sunset.
And then finally, number 7, radio or podcast?
Well, just going by the statistics, I listen to more podcasts than radio. So Yeah, I guess podcast is going to be. Let's not get into like a debate about the world of podcasting because that's a bit meta. But there's more to be learned on podcasts than on the radio. And I'm not a big music listener. People are surprised sometimes I say I'm just not really into music as a whole. And I know some people cannot even imagine a person that doesn't really like love listening to music. But for me, knowledge is a bit more motivating.
All right. Well, thank you so much for allowing us to go inside your mind. I know it can feel a little bit intrusive, but I really appreciate it. So let's dive into the conversation. You spent a couple decades, in a very different field on many levels, but for the last, since I think 2012, you founded the Irrational Agency. What are the things that have really surprised you about the research you guys are doing on human behavior?
So I think what's changed in that period is what I've realized is the importance of storytelling and narrative. And so at the time when we started this in 2012, and I'd been working in behavioral science a little bit for the few years before that, we were taking an approach that was a bit more classical kind of economic modeling style, even though it was still behavioral economics, it was still about psychology. It was about things like understanding preferences and looking at models of utility, but how the utility function is different in a behavioral world and in the classical rational world. But what I think hadn't become clear yet was the importance of narrative and how the stories that we build in our heads, the mental models that we have of the world and how we navigate those mental models using, we tell ourselves a story to make the world make sense. And that story motivates us, that story gives us pleasure, that story guides ultimately our choices and behavior. That is what is the biggest change over those 10 years. And so that's probably the, I guess, what I'd call the biggest surprise.
Then you are a mathematician and an economist. Why are you so interested in people?
Why am I interested in people? Oh, wow. Okay. So when I started my career, when I started my business as a mathematician, I was in technology, I was building software. And I think I had this assumption that people were rational. I studied my classical economic theory at school. I read the business books and more or less everything was based on the assumption. If you do X, then Y will follow that. If you sell things cheaper, more people will buy it. If you add more features to your products, more people will buy it. And so I tried to run my software business on that basis for many years. And basically it was really, really hard work. And it wasn't working that well. It took kind of confronting myself with this question of why are people not behaving as they logically should behave according to mathematics, to realize that, okay, one, that there's another whole level of psychology that I was not appreciating. But secondly, then, as I explored and learned more about that, I went to behavioral economics conferences. I started in, I guess, 2006, 2007, just quite at the beginning of this movement. I started to learn about the work of Kahneman and Thaler and Ariely and these leading thinkers. And I realized there was this whole area that hadn't been explored. But secondly, I thought, you know what? I can still bring my mathematical approach and talents to this world. I can still use mathematics to analyze human behavior, even if it doesn't follow the rules of classical rationality. And so the analogy I use sometimes, I don't know if you ever watched The Big Bang Theory, but there's an episode where Sheldon, with his like his mathematical kind of expert physics head, decides, I want to understand how to make friends. And he kind of has a whiteboard of like, how do you make a friend? And how do you analyze like what humans need from each other in friendship, using like mathematical language and formulas. And although I hope I'm not quite as much a caricature as that, but that was definitely my, my same idea. You can bring the power of mathematics to understand human thinking, human behavior. And I guess one of the ways that shows up is in pricing, because prices are numbers. And so that's probably one of the reasons that I came into writing the book, was the idea that price is a mathematical manifestation of all of the irrationalities of human behavior.
Yeah, this is a great chapter in history where minds like yourself, if you would have looked back 40, 50 years, I mean, this was unheard of, right? This, behavioral psychology, using underpinned by economic theories and merging theories. I mean, one of the most fascinating parts about, numbers is that there's just so much of our brains are driven by numbers and systems and so forth. In chapter 3 of your book, you speak about reading your customer's mind.
Yeah.
And I know from when you wrote this book to now, so much has evolved, but so much has remained the same, that your ability to read a customer's mind is integral, is key to your work at Irrational Agency, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you guys go about it?
Yeah. Okay. So I think one thing that we do is we kind of split the mind up, because there's so much going on in a person's head. We look at it through these different dimensions, and you will know, of course, about the classical, system 1 versus system 2 division. System 1 is the unconscious automatic reaction. System 2, the deliberative calculation. We look at what's going on, something else that we call system 3, which is the imaginative part of the mind. So this is where that storytelling takes place. It's where, if you encounter a new product or a new brand, you project yourself into the future. You imagine, what might it be like to eat this new flavor of ice cream, to drive this new car, to consume this new product. And you're using mental simulation. You're feeling the emotions that you would experience if you bought this product. And you're evaluating, does this story have a happy ending? And am I going to buy it or not? So we start by splitting the mind up into these different areas of concern. And then we use market research tools that we've developed to drill in, dive into the what's going on in each of those sections. So it's, you could think a little bit like you're getting inside my mind in the beginning of the podcast. it's ways of asking questions that get past the surface. Because you ask someone a straightforward question, especially about pricing. You say, how much do you want to pay for this box of cereal? Well, that person's going to tell you the lowest number they can come up with, because they think that that will make you sell it cheaper. Secondly, they're going to kind of project the world they want to live in, where cereal is cheaper, where products are easier to buy. And they don't want to confront themselves with the difficult trade-offs that really do confront us in real life, which is, well, if I buy this, I'm spending the money and I can't buy that anymore. So everybody wants to avoid those difficult tensions. And so for all those reasons, they'll give you a price that is basically too low, is inaccurate. And it's the same when you ask almost any kind of research question. People will, not through their own fault, but through their own biases, will give you answers that are wrong. And so we need to develop specific methodologies that ask very indirect questions. So, for example, you might put people into a simulated scenario. That might be through talking them through, tell us about the last time you went to the grocery store. What day was it? What was the weather like? Did you drive or did you walk or did you take the bus? When you walked in, what did you see? And then we might show them some pictures of a grocery store to help create that whole atmosphere and put them into the real mindset. And then we'll confront them with those tensions and those challenges. So we'll show them a shelf. And so here are the 8 boxes of cereal you could buy, and you've only got, $20 or £15 or 200 rands in your pocket. What are you going to spend it on? And then if they take one box of cereal off the shelf, then we take the money out of their virtual wallet so they can't spend it again. And so then they're really confronted with, oh, wait, if I actually see this cereal, will I really pay the $8 or the $4 that it costs? And you start to get these a much more real picture of their true behavior. You can look at how quickly do they answer a question, because that tells you, is this a very deeply intuitively held belief, or is it something I had to rationalize? And you can look at, and this is where the narratives come back in, we ask people about what word do they associate, what feelings do they have when they are in this situation, and the stories that they tell as they make the choice reveal the way they're thinking and reveal the whole depth that's sitting behind that choice. So there's a whole range of different research methods that we use to, you know, read that mind. And I say, you know, read that mind is in quotes, because you're never going to get a perfect read, but you can get a lot better than just asking people questions as a traditional survey or focus group would do.
Do you know, let me just say, this System 3 concept is brilliant. I came across Dr. Tamara Gendler. I think she was at Princeton or Yale.
Okay.
And she coined this concept called an alief, A-L-I-E-F, which is your imagination's beliefs. It just fits really wonderful alongside your System 3.
Mm. I've seen her work, actually. I hadn't thought of it in exactly that way, but that's a really nice comparison. I will look that up again.
Okay.
And, I think that's it. Thank you for making that link, because that is really interesting to explore.
Yeah, I love the System 3 idea, and I'm going to use it a lot, and I will give you plenty of credit, I promise.
Brilliant, thank you.
So what's one of the ways we can use price to increase demand?
Well, this is where you have to look at the classical way of using price to increase demand, is that you cut the price and the quantity demanded goes up. But then of course you're losing all your margin. So you don't want to increase volume at the expense of margin. So the couple of ways to reframe the prices that people perceive. One is the classical one is you stick another product above the one that you're selling at a higher price. So this creates an anchoring bias. So if you're selling your product at $5, just put an $11 product next to it, and suddenly $5 looks pretty good value. You're likely to increase the demand for that. Another is to change the range structure. So let's say you have a standard and premium product. Again, let's say $5 for standards, $8 for premium. Then as soon as you stick a super premium of $12 above that, then people will move up from the standard to the premium, because they'll go to the middle option instead of the lower option. So all of these are about changing the way people perceive the price without actually changing the price itself. And often to do that, you need to go just be a little bit beyond just the number on the price tag, and be willing to innovate with your product range and, you know, add those premium versions or change the price of something that sits alongside it. Essentially, every price, every purchase decision we make, the price is always in comparison to something, because numbers are so abstract for human beings that five on its own, $5, five rand, is that a good or a bad price? Is that high or low price? It is meaningless. It's only a high or low price compared to something in a certain context. So if you can change the context, and that can be by adding other products at the top end, or it could be by repositioning this product as, you know, an experiential consumption that has a whole emotional benefit or a story attached to it, and rather than just a commodity that just serves a material need, all of these are ways to change that context and increase the perceived value and get people to pay more.
Yeah, awesome. So well said, so simple. I love that. I can tell you spend a lot of time. You guys have been an awesome team. I was on your website and I can see your research team, and the way you set up your team is really, really, you know, it's diverse in that, you know, you've got a number of different disciplines that really cover all sides of this. So
yeah,
the final question I'm going to ask you is about what's in your appendix. But before we go there, I want to talk about quickly self-worth.
Right.
And I've always thought that, you know, some people just inherently know their value. Some people know that the price they've put on themselves, you know, instinctively they trigger that sort of same effect back, and people feel that they're more. I mean, I had to check myself early in my career when I was charging for talks. You know, there's always this kind of like imposter feeling sometimes where, am I charging too much? You know, I haven't written this. You know, the level of book is Lee Caldwell or Roy Southern, you know, And, you know, let's talk a little bit about how price affects how other people see us and how we see ourselves.
Yeah. Okay. That's a really important topic. I've spoken to so many people, and you know, I include myself in this earlier in my career, who undervalue themselves in both in terms of their own kind of emotional value that they place on themselves, but therefore, of course, that feeds through into pricing. And you know, so many people who are, you know, a freelancer who might be, you know, charging a few hundred pounds, a few hundred dollars a day for their work, when other people in their sector are charging literally 10 times the amount. And it does come in part, it does come from a lack of self-value, a lack of self-esteem and self-belief. And I actually, my fiance has written about imposter syndrome. And this is one of the things that we talk about together is, about the idea that imposter syndrome, where you feel like, do I have a right to be in this room? Do I have a, you know, should I be, am I good enough to be here? One that affects the value that you charge, like it feeds into that conversation you have with clients, but also the, one of the big insights she's had is that this is a story that is given to you. This is not, you know, when you walk into a room, especially if you're young or, often if you're a woman or if you're a person of color, there's the systems around you are telling you that you shouldn't be there. This is not just like a psychological flaw in you. This is something that you're being sold. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons you're being sold that is implicitly to keep your price down. And so, this is something that we can and should be fighting back on. One of the things we tell ourselves, because we know how to do what we do, we automatically undervalue it. So if I know how to give pricing advice, or if you know how to talk to people about behavioral psychology, because you know it, you think, oh, well, it can't be that complicated. I know it. It's pretty simple. Like I'm an expert at this, and therefore it is simple for me, but it's not simple for the person you're selling to. So they put a much higher value on it than you do. And one of the best piece of advice I ever had from a business consultant in my first business was, he just said, look, double your prices, see what happens. You may lose a couple of customers, but you probably keep most of them and you'll be making twice the money. So, wow. I would say to anyone out there who's a freelancer, who is selling their services, just try selling them for more. See what happens. You probably people will wear a much bigger price than you are currently charging in most cases. So that will feed back to you. And once you start charging those amounts and you see that people are willing to pay it, you're going to retell yourself the story that you're telling about your own worth, and you're going to feel better.
Lee, we should be partnering. I'm going to put this out actually on the air. At some stage, we should really think about collaborating, but. Let's close this out with, you know, you've got 30 questions in your appendix. Yep. What are two of the most important questions that people should be asking to know if their price is optimal?
Okay. All right. Well, so here's question 12. Which customers have you chosen not to sell to? And so this could go back to that self-esteem, self-value question. Are there people out there who don't value what you do? Well, stop trying to sell to them. Stop trying to make your pricing work for them. Because if you cut out the bottom 20% of your market that values you the least, then that's where you can probably double your price. And the top 80% will still keep buying from you. So figure out who you're not selling to because they don't value you enough. And the other is, do you make the intangible tangible? So I talked about the importance of intangible because a lot of what we sell, and a lot of the value that we provide is associated with the stories, the intangible things that come with your service or your product. However, it can be hard to convey that to many customers in a way that's to them that they can rationalize putting a price on and paying for. So maybe think about some of those stories. Think about some of the intangible aspects of your service and encode them, turn them into something physical. So if you're a consultant, maybe when you deliver your report to your client, don't just email them a PDF, but package it up in a printed bound product, have it couriered over to their office, and it's going to sit on their desk for longer. They're going to notice that you've made the effort, made the investment, and they're going to see, okay, you value these words that you've written enough to create this physical object. I should probably value them more as well.
Yeah, this is really awesome. Guys, please get this book. But more importantly, go to their website. It's the irrationalagency.com, right?
Irrationalagency.com. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you guys have a couple of articles and, you know, people can get in contact with you. Do you have a newsletter of some sort you send out?
Absolutely. If you just put your email address in on our website and we send out, new insights in behavioral science and new insights into markets and people's psychology every few weeks. So please do sign up or just contact me on LinkedIn or Twitter, where I'm at Lee Blue, L-E-I-G-H Blue. And I'd love to talk to any of your listeners who want to chat about these topics.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And maybe at some point we can have your wife want to talk a little bit about her work as well. So thank you so much, Lee. I really, really appreciate it. Enjoy your time in Canada, in Vancouver. Enjoy TED. It's always an extraordinary experience, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Wonderful to meet you, Timothy. I look forward to speaking again soon. Thanks.
Bye. Cheers. Take care. Bye-bye now.